バラスはよおばにえらごらままけりらいを
ままけりあお
あばらすわよ
Good morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks, a Black Arts and Culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. And that was Zion Trinity singing the opening prayer for Eshu Legba. And this is the 50th anniversary weekend for the Black Panther Party. And there is a conference and celebration gala happening at the Oakland Museum of California. It started yesterday, October 20th, and it continues through October 23rd. The topic is, where do we go from here? And conference kicked off really wonderfully yesterday. A lot of people here from around the world, and it continues today. I believe the workshops start at 11 a.m., and some highlights for today are there's going to be a panel looking at political prisoners and prisoners of war. There are also some panels looking at the Black Panther newspaper, and quite a few really great panels, and as well as Saturday. And Saturday also is going to feature, not at the Oakland Museum, but at Frank Ogawa Plaza in downtown Oakland, the 14th and Broadway, there's going to be an all-day concert with speaking. And then on Sunday is going to be at the Infirmary or Little Bobby Hutton Park, where there's going to be a dedication of the Little Bobby Hutton Grove. So, and then the 50th anniversary celebration gala dinner is going to be Saturday, October 22nd, 7 to 11 p.m. At the Oakland Museum in the Garden. So that's going to be a really wonderful celebration. So a couple of the things that are happening are free. The concert downtown is free, and the dedication ceremony on Sunday the 23rd at Bobby Hutton Park or the Infirmary Park from 1 to 5 is also free. And then at Laney College there's going to be some films. There's a film tonight, actually this afternoon at 12:15, COINTELPRO 101. And at 3 p.m., Polynesian Panthers is going to be screened. And on Saturday at 12:15, 41 and Central is going to be, 41st and Central is going to be screened. And then after that, Lords of the Revolution is going to be screened. So it should be pretty exciting. And there's a website that you can visit to find out all about, you know, the schedules and things like that. And I'm looking to see if I can find the website for you. Or you can just put 50th anniversary in the search engine and you can find it. So today we are going to play an interview with Albert Woodfox that we conducted a while back when he first got out of Angola State Prison on his birthday, February 19th this year. And he's going to be in town today for that panel this morning about the political prisoners. That's going to be real, really good. And tomorrow at 7 o'clock we're going to have a special broadcast because tomorrow is the actual day of the that the Black Panther Party was founded 50 years ago. And it's also Bobby Seale's birthday, so I want to say happy birthday to him in advance. This evening at the Berklee Repertory Theater, this afternoon at 2 and then again at 7, there's going to be a screening of another film looking at COINTELPRO. And there's going to be a panel. Bobby Seale, Kathleen Cleaver, and others are going to be on that panel. So that should be pretty exciting. So I am going to play Wadada Leo Smith, and then we're going to shift over. We're going to play Spiritual Light, and then we're going to go right into the interview with Albert Woodfox. That was pre-recorded earlier this year, after he was released.
Thank you.
So my first question is, I just wanted to tell you that I'm interested in stories of freedom, transformation, and faith, and I think these questions all have to do something with those themes. And the first question is, the three of you, Herman Wallace, Robert H. King, and you, Albert Woodfox, were known by the names that evoked a level of black consciousness. Your name, Albert Shaka Sinq Woodfox, evoked two warriors, and King's is Mojo for Mojo or Unity, and Herman Wallace was called Hook. My question is, if you could talk about the legacies of the two warriors who resisted enslavement, Shaka and Sinq, whose names you carry, and how these ancestors speak to and through you.
Well, Shaka, one of my comrades, gave me that name. Mm-hmm. And I had great admiration and respect for Joseph Sinq. So, you know, he was in prison and he was fighting for his freedom as same as I was. So I thought that I would honor him by taking his name. I think Zulu was the one gave me the name Shaka, which, as you know, in the Zulu language, it means fire beetle. And he thought that, you know, I had the type of passion to get things done like King Shaka.
Mm-hmm. So you said in Zulu, Shaka means what?
Well, Shaka, in the Zulu language, if you know, means it's the name of a fire beetle.
Fire, a fire eater or fire, really?
Beater. Like B-E-A-T-E-R.
Oh.
And I think the story goes, you know, when Shaka's mama was impregnated, and Shaka's father was the son of a small chief, and they went to him and told him about the pregnancy and stuff, and I think he being a mockery, so like she was, you know, she must have got pregnant for a fire beetle. And I think, you know, so I think that's how it got. I'm not completely sure, you know, I've read all this, various articles and stuff about King Shaka.
Yeah. Oh, nice. Okay.
Those are some kids, you know. Led a mutiny on the slave ship, the Amistad tried to, you know, sail back to Africa.
Right.
Why did I get captured?
Yeah, yeah, and they won the case in the American courts.
Yeah.
Similar to you winning your case in these courts. It took a while.
Yeah, well, you know, at the time I was, you know, all of us fighting real hard through the courts, trying to get up, win our freedom.
I wonder if you could talk about your childhood in New Orleans, your parents and siblings, and dreams you had as a boy for your future.
Well, you know, my stepfather was in the Navy. So we as a family, you know, we did a lot of traveling. I think the places that made the most impact on me was when we were living in a military project in California called Quonset Huts and North Carolina and New Orleans. You know, I spent a great part of my pre and teen years living in a my grandparents had a small farm. And, you know, eventually we wound up back in, you know, moving back to New Orleans. You know, as far as hopes and dreams, I had none. You know, my generation, you know, racism was still prominent, you know, I was just a kid running the street, it devolved in a lot of stuff. Petty crime. My mom was trying to fight to take me out of the street, but you know, the voice of the street was louder than the voice of my mom, and the voice of the Black Panther Party was louder than the voice of the street, which is why I eventually wound up joining the Black Panther Party.
So you said when your stepfather was in the military, you traveled. So where in California were you living?
Well, I think we was in Los Angeles, but he was based at I think it still got this big vaulted military base somewhere around San Diego.
Okay.
But we lived in a military project.
Mm-hmm.
It was called a Quas and a Hudson.
Okay. And where was the farm your grandparents had? Was that in Louisiana?
A small town called LaGrange, North Carolina.
Oh, okay.
Between Winston and Salem, North Carolina. Small.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know
mm-hmm.
what it's like now. I know our farm is pretty much. One of my cousins live in it's just like a small plot of land with a trailer, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How did you like living in the country?
It was good times, bad times, you know. Like I say, I was still, you know, a young kid.
Mm-hmm.
And just trying to, you know, then didn't be a part of whatever was going on in that area, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is the 50th anniversary year of the founding of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, and much, if not all, of the judicial attacks from the warden, Burl Kane, to Louisiana State Attorney General Buddy Caldwell were based on your political activism as a Black Panther Party member. I think one could say you were already a black revolutionary before you arrived at Angola State Prison. Your flight from the Parrish Prison is testament to that. Plus theorists Vance Fanon, James Baldwin, Malcolm X, W.B. Du Bois, perhaps Alby Elijah Muhammad and others, fueled your liberation ideology. Walimu told me about your prison escape. And either he or King showed me the New Orleans prison where this happened. One doesn't often hear about the maroon culture behind bars. But your escape from physical and spiritual captivity attests to this phenomena. So as long as you could talk about the Black Panther Party members you met in New York and your transformation at 21 years old. And then later, when captured and returned to New Orleans and sentenced to Angola State Prison in place of solitary confinement, what did the party mean to you and to the men at Angola? How did the Black Panther Party at Angola serve the men there as you organized for justice and human rights?
Well, my initial introduction to the Panthers, I escaped in 1969 from the courthouse, and eventually I wound up in New York and Harlem because, I kind of knew Harlem from... when I was a petty criminal, we made trips there for various things. So, when I got to New York, I automatically went to Harlem. And, I saw the brothers and sisters that was in the party moving around the neighborhood, selling papers and doing other things, escort some of the senior citizens to various places. And it was, for me, it was the first time seeing that kind of pride and that kind of fearlessness in African-American people. And, to be honest, they had some very beautiful sisters. So my initial intent was just to try to get with one of the sisters, And eventually I got arrested for armed robbery that I didn't do, and I was found found not guilty at trial. But while I was in the Manhattan House of Detention, the tunes, as you call it, I was being held on the 8th floor. And they had the Panther 21 shootout. And so a couple of the members of the party was put on the chair with me. The only one name I remember clearly was his name was Alfred Kane. He's alive and he lives in New York somewhere right now. And so these the whole political classes and discussions on the tier. So I was a 10th, you know, but I, at the time I really didn't understand what the teachings were and stuff, because you know I had no political background or activities or anything. I was just a petty criminal, a kid of the streets, you know. But one a guy came now from upstate New York. He filed a writ, and him and I was in the cell together. And so he said, "Here's a book you could read. It's a real good book." And the book was A Different Drummer. And up to that time, you know, I didn't realize how one person could make a difference. And I read this book, and all of a sudden, all the things that the Panthers were talking about in the classes that we were having up here, it's kind of like, you know, a level of consciousness, a level of consciousness developed in me, and I began to understand what was being said and seeing connections, how it affected my life, how it affected my family, how it affected African Americans particularly. And so for the first time, as I said, I heard a voice that was louder than the voice of the street. Around that time, you know, the Attica riots happened, and all the city jails, or you know, and the boroughs, they went up in protest, and so you know, I was always a bright kid, always able to communicate well, and somehow I found myself as a representative of the 8th floor. And so from there, after everything was, you know, over, they shipped me out to New Queens. And, you know, they went up again at Attica. So we, in support, you know, we went up, you know, took over the New Queens House of Detention. And, you know, once that was over, eventually I was sent back to the Manhattan House of Detention for a trial. And I was charged with armed robbery. And really, you know, what had happened is the guy was a booking, and I hit him for some money. And so I went to, you know, they had a little grocery store, and they're like, well, I don't have enough money down here. Let's go up to my apartment. So I said, you know, I was naive. And went up there, and they jumped and beat me up real bad and called the police and said I tried to rob them. And so, you know, I went to trial, and as I say, I got the jury filed me not guilty of robbery. So that was my introduction to the Black Panther Party. Now, because of my political activities and during the riots, I lost my extradition hearing and was returned to New Orleans. They had red leather stamped on my jacket, on my record, a militant. So when I got to New Orleans, Orleans Parish Prison, they were holding the Panther Brothers who had been in the shootout with the police at the Zaire Project.
Mm-hmm.
Malik Raheem was one of them. And, you know, it was there that I actually joined the Black Panther Party.
Oh, okay.
As to how we, you know, to start to build a party at a Cole, a guy named Scott was in leadership position. So when I joined the party, and when they sent me to Angola, his instructions to me was educate and agitate, and to, you know, each one teach one. So you have a great responsibility as a member of the party to organize and to fight against injustice. And so when I got to Angola, of course, Harbor was there.
Mm-hmm.
And the camp that he was living in, the camp, they had to renovate it, so they moved all of them on what's called a walkway. That's the main prison. And I knew about him. I didn't know him personally. But, you know, I sought him out, and we, you know, we talked, and we thought we, you know, put up our observations of what was going on in Angola. We felt that it was our duty and our responsibility to take action. So we start organizing and talking to guys, holding classes, stuff like it there. And so eventually we started the prison branch of the Black Panther Party. And when Brent Miller was murdered, you know, we became the obvious suspect, you know, and I was after the first guy that they locked in a dungeon for Brett Miller's murder. And they moved us to CCR the next day, and until I walked out of West Hill Santa Parish a free man, I've always been held in isolation, solitary confinement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how did you all, you and Herman and then King came in a little later, so how would you describe your relationship, and how did you keep the divisiveness away from you, given the manipulative nature of power and powerlessness in prison, a place where what happens to one's body is not in one's control? So how did you keep the unity there between you all and you know, and your other comrades? Because they came after you all pretty hard.
Know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, as I said, you know, I knew who Herman Wallace was. You know, we had never, none of us were friends. We were aware of each other. And,
mm-hmm.
and you know, by the time King was brought to Angola, we were hundreds of hours already in CCR. So King, you know, he had joined the party as well. So, you know, he, along with us, noticed a lot of racism and exploitation and injustice that was going on at CCR. So we felt it was our responsibility as members of the party to organize against it and try to make CCR a better place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Can you talk about some of the changes that you all were a result of your organizing? Because I know one of them had to do with stopping the rape of the young men that were coming in. And another had to do with having them not put your food on the ground, your trays on the ground. But I think that involved a hunger strike. So could you talk about some of the actions that you all instituted. And I also know that you all, I think you taught people how to read while you all were inside. Could you talk about some of the things you did and maybe give an example of how you did it?
When we formed the anti-rape squad, mm-hmm. Herman and I were still in population. You know, just some observations, and, you know, we used to see these guys, mostly young kids, 17, 18 years old, who had been ganged or raped or whatever and forced into that life. You know, it's a horrible thing to see a human spirit destroyed in someone, you know. And, you know, we just felt as though that we couldn't just allow this to keep going without trying to do something about it. So we formed anti-rape squads from, you know, some of the guys who had joined the prison branch of the Black Panther Party. And every day or every Thursday, they would bring in and they'd call guys fresh fish. So we would go down, and when they get off the bus, you know, it's usually when the attacks were starting, and we would introduce ourselves as members of the Black Panther Party and, you know, talk about sex slaves and being forced into it. And, you know, you don't have to allow this. We will give you as much protection and help as we can, but it all comes down to you. You have to be willing to fight for your manhood. You have to be willing to stand up to whatever comes as a result of that. And so we kind of like put an end to the slave market for a while. Mm-hmm. And as you know, with Brent Miller, the most murdered, you know, of course, they locked us up. But one of our comrades, his name was Irvin Bro, they called him Life. Life tried to continue protecting young kids as they came in, but he was by himself. And he was eventually killed for it. He was killed while he did the act of trying to save one of the young guys.
You said his name was Irvin Brewer?
Bro. I think he spelled his name B-R-E-U-X.
Okay.
But his AKA was Life.
Life. Let's see. I was wondering if you could talk about your physical unshackling and what this recalibration or sinking of mind and body feels like. Every time I see a brother or sister shackled, I think about our ancestors and imagine what it must have been like for them, and I'm just a witness. How must it be for you who bears the weight?
You know, I was still developing. And, you know, reading a lot of stuff, first time in my life, reading about slavery in America and institutional racism and stuff, you know, so you develop a level of consciousness. You know, you begin to develop a philosophy that's supported by, you know, strong moral principles and beliefs. A value system in which, you know, human life is more important than anything, and it's worth risking your life to protect. And, you know, I think I really came into my own where everything kind of came together was in 1940. Well, you know, I'll just say I was in my early 40s, about 41, 42. Mm-hmm. And up to that point, all of my struggles were mostly my passion. And around that time, you know, I started to understand that struggle alone is not enough. that you have a have a goal, a purpose. You have to develop certain principles in order to preserve whatever achievements you made in your struggles. And so I became more political. And, you know, I just, along with King and Hooks, we just struggle, you know. We and as far as God holds the reading and writing, we you know, I took a page out of my experience with the Panthers in New York. And so we started holding classes, you know. One day we would have political classes, which we would just discuss what was going on in America and society, and what was being done to change. And other days, you know, we had used to have educational class where we taught guys, you know, how to read, how to do math. You know, we talked about history and geography, you know, and try to, you know, raise their level of consciousness, give them a purpose that was governed by principles and values.
Did you rehearse your release in your mind over the past years when you were so close to freedom, having been found suitable and then denied release 3 times? And does, now that you're free, does the physical freedom ever feel, or does it feel overwhelming? And do you miss anything about imprisonment?
Well, you know, actually, like I say, once I gained the level of consciousness, mm-hmm. and realized that struggle had to take place on many levels, that's when King, I, and Herman started studying the law, criminal law and civil law.
Mm-hmm.
So filing actions at the courts against certain things was just another tool for us to use. And so that's what we did, you know. And another guy named Hayes Williams had filed something earlier. So, and around, I think it was 73 or 74, the DOC, Louisiana DOC, and the Justice Department and the federal court hammered out a consent decree to change what was going on in Angola. And from there on, you know, it was just a matter of, you know, continue to struggle, continue to educate myself, continue to develop a level of consciousness. As far as my freedom, you know, right now everything is moving kind of fast. And so I'm just trying to, you know, adjust to being free, to be able to, you know, walk outside if I want, you know, go somewhere and purchase something. So all these are new experiences for me. And I haven't quite reached the level that I need to survive in society, but I'm not too far away from it. You know, I have a great support committee. I have friends who love and cherish my friendship, people who have been struggling for 10, 15 years to win my freedom. Mm-hmm. And, you know, now that it has happened, they are more determined than ever to be a support community for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. On your to-do list was a visit to visit the grave sites of your mother, sister, and brother-in-law. I wonder if you could talk about the Egungun or ancestors and their role, specifically your mother, sister, and brother-in-law. But the ancestors in general as well, and their role in your life and their importance in African liberation?
You know, well, as far as my mom, when she passed away, you know, there had always been a tradition in prison in Angola when the sibling or parent passed away, you were allowed to go to the funeral. And, you know, the funeral is a time for people to say their final goodbye in their heart and their soul to that family member they have lost. So I was denied that. You know, Brother Cain, who preached about Christian values and all that, he refused to let me go and say goodbye to my mom, as well as my sister. My brother-in-law was a childhood friend. We had been friends since he was 8 years old. And so there was this sense of emptiness about this. And I always dreamed that if I ever went free, the first thing that I would do was go and say goodbye to my loved ones. And that's what happened. You know, Michael and I drove away from the prison, and we went straight to the cemetery, but it was locked because of the time. So we went to where my sister and my brother-in-law were buried, and, you know, we said goodbye. And, you know, it was just like this great weight was lifted off of my shoulder. So the next day, we went and we were able to see my mom, and we put flowers. We bought some roses, and I put the roses on our grave. And we went back and put roses on my sister's grave and my brother-in-law. And it just so happened that one of my brother's child and my niece was buried there too. So we went to her grave and put flowers on her grave. And I can't tell you the differences made in me, you know. I feel as though I've achieved a lot, but not enough. And, you know, no matter what I do now, being a social activist will always be a part of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was wondering, you know, since Angola State Prison is a former slave plantation, and most of the inmates are descendants of formerly enslaved African people, and the prison administrators descendants of slave owners, and that that particular social and political institution. I was wondering, actually my father, he spoke of picking cotton and cutting sugarcane with the guards on horses, carrying shotguns, and I remember thinking that it sounded like something out of a film, except the guns shot real bullets. I was wondering if just sort of being in that place and that energy, because a lot of people, you know, never got out of Angola State Prison. They would die there and be buried there. I was wondering if that tangible energy, if you could feel that, and did that in any way encourage your resolve to resist the inhumanity and brutality of the place and the system?
Well, you know, you know, it always goes back to as you embrace what you believe in, as your level of consciousness develops, your dedication and your determination becomes stronger. And that's pretty much what happened to me. You know, I mean, as I read about chattel slavery, you know, and how it affected the slaves psychologically and mentally and morally, you know, just I began to notice some of the same sisters, some of the same symptoms in the guys in prison, you know, because far off another. You know, it was just a situation where we were living in modern-day chattel slavery. The mentality of the security people, they used to call them free men at that time, was that we were property. We were property not only of the state, but we there were their personal property. So the interaction of both the prisoners and the security people, you know, I became more aware of it. And as a result of it, I developed, you know, how to counteract it or how to, you know, resist it. And so that's what I did, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, whom I'm sure you know, she wrote the ISIS papers. She made her transition early January for the ancestor realm, and she writes that that we are at war, a war against black people, more specifically black men. If we look at the state of black America less than 200 years after legal slavery ended, we see that the Civil War unified and consolidated the national white community, however, did little for black Americans, despite legislation which states otherwise, you know, December 1865 onward. Black people, black American descendants of enslaved Africans specifically, hold a unique position in the narrative structure which excludes them from citizenship and participation in a document their ancestors assembled and hold the copyright to. Public spaces are shrinking where black bodies can assemble without harm. A moving black body is a target, a stationary one, suicide. An assembly of black men is seen as threatening and illegal. Affordable housing is shrinking, and with it, legal occupations for black bodies to at least have temporary relief from persecution. We've not even addressed the economic instability which keeps black men outside this racialized power structure. And King told me about the 72-hour rule, where in New Orleans, the police will pick up a black man, hold him without charges for 72 hours, while his detainers looked for open cases that they could match, and then if nothing was found, releasing them from captivity. But more often than not, the man had lost his job, which was against the law. Unemployment meant the same black man could be arrested again, and this time detained indefinitely. Have you thought about the cyclical nature of this history as pertains to the black male body, and how to interrupt this phenomenological idea? What James A. Noel, professor of American religion at San Francisco Theological Seminary, centers in an Atlantic worldview of imagined matter. Whiteness, pre- and post-colonial, cannot define blackness or black consciousness socially, politically, spiritually, or culturally. Yet the dominant cultures predicated on whiteness has designed systems which do just that. How have you defied such classification and remain, let's say, free from disease? And I was wondering if you could maybe, some things you maybe hadn't already touched on, maybe share your inoculation protocol, like the steps to wellness, with our people who are struggling with isolation, identity, and authenticity.
Well, for me, and, you know, Kane, I, Harmon, and I, whenever we got a chance to communicate with one another, you know, we were always frustrated that it seemed as though every other ethnic group make up the human race have this one thing that brings them together, regardless of class status, gender differences. And we seem to, you know, we will always have wondered why is this not the same with African Americans? What is it? Why can't we find one issue that crosses all lines and we are able to come together? To give you a prime example of the presidential race right now with this guy Donald Trump. You know, he plays and exploits the worst elements in people. I remember reading this story about these black ministers meeting with him, and I could not for the hell of me understand why. He has made very clear that he thinks that white Americans are superior to anyone in America and around the world. So what was the purpose for them meeting with this guy? You know, was it personal interest or prestige or what, you know? And now, you know, that even to now, that is a baffling situation with me as to why we as a ethnic member of the human race, why we can't, you know, do what's best for ourselves, you know. I've always said, you know, I'd rather wrap newspaper around my feet to walk than solicit a place of business that has absolutely contempt for African Americans. I would rather drink water out of a gutter than buy a cold drink from a place of business who I know the main purpose is to exploit African-American neighborhoods. And I'm frustrated because I don't think that African-Americans in this country have that one thing. It had to go beyond just being African-Americans. I know that. Mm-hmm. But what is it? Will we ever be able to find it? And as a black man, I'm always in fear of the final elimination of myself and other African Americans. You know, when I left West Feliciana House Detention, we had a special escort. They actually escorted me, Michael, and myself all the way till we got out of, because, you know, we don't know what the specific threats were, but they were threats made, you know, as to what would happen to me. And so, you know, that type of stuff, you recognize the symptoms of chattel slavery in modern day times. You know, as African American families were torn apart. We had to find ways to take negative, hateful things, such as the N-word, to try to make it into something positive. And all these are traits from chattel slavery, you know. It was artificial survival techniques. And, we haven't moved beyond that. You know, we haven't developed that spirituality that touches all of us, no matter what. And that's, you know, one of my purposes now is to continue to fight, to continue to search, and hopefully find that. And, you know, if African Americans can find that one thing that brings all of us together, then we are stronger people. We are stronger members of the human race. And we can have a stronger impact and make things change, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When you mentioned Donald Trump, I was thinking about President Obama, you know, as he leaves office. If you could give him three things that he should do before he leaves office, what three things would you put on his to-do list?
Well, I think he should release some of the former, you know, Panther members that have been in jail 30, 40, 50 years, as myself. I think he should give pardon. Other than that, you know, it's not a lot that he can do, you know. This country has a venture capitalist economic system. And the people who own everything, that 1% you always hear about, they actually control, you know, what to call, you know, everything. Is the foundation of everything that works in society is economics. So if 1% owns the overwhelming majority of the economic output of this country, and, you know, so I don't know what Obama can do other than right now. You know, as I say, I think he should have the courage to free some of the brothers and sisters that's still being held.
So where does you know, where does your courage and your fearlessness come from? Because I'm sure you've experienced some really scary situations. You know, being
Well, you know, at one time, you know, I used to think that everything I was came from the great men in book, men and women in the history books I wrote, and as I matured, I realized that who I am was who my mother was, that my strength, my sense of determination, my strong sense of loyalty, that's who made me the man I am now. And she became my hero. And fortunately enough, I was able to sit down and talk with her before she passed and thanked her for giving me such wonderful qualities of humanity, of being a human being, and the courage, no matter how dangerous or how hopeless, to keep fighting. And, you know, there's that passion. I'm not a psychologist, so you know, I can't sit down and adequately explain. There's something in me that becomes outraged when I see an injustice or an exploitation, and when I see a human being who's defenseless and being attacked. I just, you know, have to say, if no more than say something, I will. And if I have to take other actions, I will, regardless to, you know, the consequences to myself. And that's, I think that was the strongest bond between Harmon and Wallace and Robert Hillary King, is that we all were willing to make, if necessary, the final sacrifice for what we believe in. You know, since I've been free these last 3 or 4 days, you know, King and I have had some discussions about how to, you know, things I should do to say, and, you know, I'm like, and I mean this, you know, I'm not suicidal, I don't want to die, but if it happens, it happens. I just hope it's when I'm involved in fighting for a good cause, a noble cause, you know.
We have 10 more minutes, so I have a few more questions, see if we can fit in there. Family is really important to you. Your younger brother, Michael Mabel, told me about the long drive to Angola from Houston, Texas, where he relocated after Hurricane Katrina. And it was still a long drive when he was in New Orleans. And but he made that journey religiously for over 30 years. And then I read somewhere about you're having a visit with your mother after not having a contact visit for, I think, like 15 years. Am I remembering that correctly?
I think it was about 20 years.
Oh, 20.
You know, before I had my first contact visit.
Yeah,
and we were at Camp J, which is a punishment camp, but they were renovating RC, which is the first building you see at the front gate. So we were being through reading something I filed what's called an ARP, administrative procedure, for grievances, and I realized that CCR should have had contact businesses 1974 as a part of the consent decree out of the Hayes-Williams case, but they withheld that from us. They withheld that from the inmate population. But when I, as a response to my ARP, I got the full consent decree. So as I started reading through this, I realized that there were things that the DOC, or Louisiana DOC, was supposed to do that we never knew about, you know. And one of those were contact visits. So I filed an ARP challenging that, and it was granted. And I had my first contact visit with my family after 20-something years.
Wow. How old were you when that happened, when you had to?
This was in the 80s, around 86, 87, somewhere up in there. Hmm. So I was probably, like I say, in my 40s.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, wow. And King told me that in this smaller facility, you were able to have, you know, meals from your family. I think he said you had Thanksgiving and Christmas with your family, and you had, like, food from outside.
Yeah, the West Louisiana Detention Center has a, you know, tradition of calling allowed on Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's. I actually missed the New Year because I wasn't aware that my family could bring food or anything. But it's hard to explain. It was a tremendous experience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my brother Michael is a master chef, so he can really throw down in the kitchen, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And for years, we had always talked about how great a gumbo he can cook, you know. So that, you know, that was great experience in that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But the biggest, it's difficult to put into words emotion that you get from certain things. And what was more important to me, or what was more telling to me, was the fact that I was able to eat meals that were so much love from my family and friends put into it. You know, it wasn't something the state gave me. It wasn't something I bought out of the canteen. This was something that came from my family. This was something that was touched by their hands. This is something that a part of their soul and their hearts was put into preparing these meals, you know. And I can't even find words to express how special it made me feel. You know,
mm-hmm.
You know, my brother Michael is an extraordinary human being. You know, for 40-some years, you know, he has visited me every month. You know, there was, you know, of course, there was some gaps in between because of events in his life and my life. But as soon as those events were resolved, he would, you know, be there. He would visit, you know. He's just been my rock. He's been my everything, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, I kid him, he's the big brother. You know, because right now, as we try to put my life back together, try to get, trying to get, you know, medical checkups and get that ID and stuff like that. He's just fearsome in the things he's doing right now, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so right now, I kid him, I say, you're the big brother right now. You're the patriarch of the family, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a wonderful feeling to know that you have somebody in your life that you can depend on no matter what, you know.
Yeah, because that's not the case with everyone, I'm sure.
Yeah. So it goes, you know, I plan to start writing a book, as soon as life slows down and I'm more stabilized, you know. And I don't even know if I can do justice to my brother, you know. He is such an extraordinary man, you know.
Yeah, that's really beautiful. I was wondering if you could, you know, for young people who might be sort of feeling despair because of the attack, overt attack. It's not even hidden against black people, particularly black men, young black men, older black men. I was wondering, what would you tell them? You know, what words of encouragement would you give them, and what would you tell them to do or to think or how to be? You know, what kind of lessons could you share with them?
I've always stand. I've always not tried to rationalize things that were happening to me as an individual or to African American people as a whole. We have got to get back to the spirit and the courage and the determination that African Americans had, and you know, exhibited since the first slaves were brought to this country in 1619, with emphasis on the era of the civil rights movement and stuff, you know, and we've got to be willing, you know, to face fire holes and beatings and going to jail and going to prison. We have to develop something that belongs to us. As I said earlier, you know, we have to find something that crosses economic lines, locations, difference of opinion, difference of lifestyle, you know, and until we can do that, I think we will always be in a battle just to be, just to breathe, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you have time for one more?
Sure.
Okay. Let's see. I was wondering, I'm sort of interested in sort of what's operating under the surface, you know, in the psyche or the subconscious. And I wanted to know if you were able to dream while you were in prison, and if any of those dreams were they like reoccurring, and if you were able to dream, and if you can remember any of those dreams, can you compare those dreams to the past four nights of freedom? And what those dreams look like now?
Well, you know, of course, you know, I was able to dream. I mean, that was, you know, I never lost hope that one day I would go free.
Mm-hmm.
Even though there was this feeling deep down, you know, that I'm going to die here. But, you know, that was not an excuse to fight. That was not an excuse to be willing to unite with, you know, African Americans and specifically and Americans in general. You have to stand. You have to be willing to make. I mean, you know, I'm trying not to say something negative, but what, you know, like, I think the greatest movement of this time right now is the Black Lives Matter movement, you know. And I've watched, you know, them try to malign and tear down and discredit this movement, you know. But it seems to be remaining strong, has a purpose, and hopefully someday in the future I will be able to work with them. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I meant not dream as in hope, but I meant like, you know, dreams when you go to sleep at night, you know, those those kind of dreams.
Well, most of my dreams were nightmares.
Oh.
You know, I still suffer from claustrophobia.
Mm-hmm.
claustrophobia, and still have panic attacks, you know, where I just break out sweating, and for no reason, I'm injured, obviously, but, and, you know, I don't know to what extent, but I will continue to self-evaluate myself and to continue to struggle.
So you mean
the last breath I take will be struggle.
Mhm. Yeah. So you mean like the trauma of being incarcerated, with regards to the
injury? Most of the dreams I had were nightmares, But there were a few, freedom, family, one is coming through now, I'm rebuilding my family with I have a beautiful daughter, three beautiful grandkids, and four beautiful great grandkids. So we've been spending a lot of time together and just getting to know them. And, it's been probably one of the proudest moments of my life to see that I am, the starting point of four generations.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's really lovely. Wow, that's great. Wow. Well, thank you so much. I had more, but my time is up. So perhaps, we might be able to continue this conversation at another point some other time.
Okay.
But thank you again.
Yeah,
because so
we have an appointment, and I need to get ready for that. So I need to get ready.
Oh, yes, yeah, certainly. All right. Well, you take good care, and thank you again so much, and congratulations on what a wonderful birthday, to have freedom. As a gift.
It's great.
All right, you take a
one gift. One of my dreams that did come true,
Yeah, certainly.
Freedom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's no price on that, that's for sure. All right, you take care.
Okay, well, we'll definitely talk some more, but right now I have to go and start getting ready.
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, I hope you have a really good day.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Right,
peace and blessings. Bye-bye.